Hello and welcome to day 10 of the Cosmic Shed Advent Calendar. Normal service is resumed today, so let's just open the door.
Hi everyone! I'm super excited to be catching up with Professor Bruce Drinkwater today.
Guests of the Shed a couple of times now. And just for people that might not have heard those episodes or are new listeners, would you mind just telling us kind of what you do, who you are?
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a professor of ultrasonics at the University of Bristol. So I research and teach on all things to do with ultrasonics. And that's quite a wide range of things within the field of ultrasonics. So I do levitation and tractor beams, which is, I think, where I've been mostly connected with the Cosmic Shed. But I also use ultrasound for imaging. And I'm also interested in how bats might find and eat moths, for example. So, anything to do with ultrasound excites me.
That's awesome. So, yes, the last time we saw Bruce, he came to our live event at the Planetarium where he demoed the tractor beam. So could you just explain a little bit about how the tractor beam kind of works scientifically and how we've managed to make a real one? It's not just in the realms of sci-fi anymore.
The trick in creating this is an acoustic tractor beam, one that uses sound, is to create exactly the right acoustic field. So that means the sort of pattern of loud and quiet sounds. So you have to get this right. And so we do that with lots of little loudspeakers. They're ultrasonic loudspeakers, because although this is acoustics, it's in the ultrasonic range where you can't hear it. And we do that actually for quite a good reason, in as much as we have to use very loud sounds to make these things grab and move objects. So if it was in the acoustic range, then it would be deafening. So we move it into the ultrasonic range so it's not deafening. Then we use lots of little loudspeakers to create this particular field. And the easiest way to visualize it is the object that you're trying to grab is in a quiet region, and the sound around it is really loud in all directions. So if the particle, the object you're grabbing, tries to move in any direction, it gets blasted back into the quiet region by this sort of sphere or this region of high intensity sound. And then with these little loudspeakers, By carefully controlling the output of those, we can then move the acoustic field, and then the object that you've trapped moves with the acoustic field. So that's the kind of general idea.
That's very exciting stuff. So have there been any other developments in the tractor beam area since we last saw you?
Well, earlier in the year, we had quite a breakthrough in as much as we found a way of grabbing and moving bigger objects than we'd previously moved before. So the biggest thing to date we've moved is a 2-centimeter object in size, which might not sound too big, but considering previously it was millimeters in size, that's quite a breakthrough. And the from a scientific perspective, what was good there was the object that we're moving now is bigger than a wavelength. And so in acoustics, anything to do with waves, the scale that's always set is the wavelength. And so we're using about a wavelength of about a centimeter, and we moved a 2-centimeter object. And so that kind of broke a bit of a barrier that others and ourselves had previously had, where everything we'd moved had to be smaller than a wavelength. And that meant if you wanted to move big objects, then you needed a long wavelength, which means low frequency, which means audible, which means, you know, deafening sounds. So we kind of broke that link. So that was quite an important scientific achievement we did earlier on in the year, which we're still working on, improving it even further.
Yeah, excellent. So can we get even bigger than that?
Yeah, I think so, yes. What we're currently working on, it's not quite out there in the public domain, is moving lots of things simultaneously. So a lot of the work we've done previously has always been moving one object. So we pushed the size limit earlier on in the year, and then now we've got some really nice results where we're moving lots of different things, up to 20 objects simultaneously. So imagine these 20 objects in front of you. So it's like 20 little tractor beams all moving independently of one another. That's a sneak preview of some work that will be coming out either later on this year or early next year.
Well, that's very exciting. What kind of applications does that have, if you can talk about it?
Well, all sorts of applications for holding and positioning things in, for example, production lines without any moving parts. So which would be particularly useful if you're trying to assemble delicate things like electronic components or dangerous or sensitive things like pharmaceuticals, for example. But I mean, I think the other thing I'm interested in, we haven't done it yet, and a bit like the work that you yourself were involved in until recently at the university, do this on a micro scale. So moving small things like microparticles and cells, because at the moment we've got a lot of capabilities at the large scale, which are really cool, but we don't yet have those tools available at the micro scale, where actually a lot of the really exciting applications like biomedical applications are. So imagine you could have these 20 or not even need 20, lots of little microscopic hands, so that when you're trying to do some work under a microscope, you see all these cells or objects that you want to move. You can pick and place them and move them, bring them together, shove them off to one side, who knows what. But I think there's a lot of applications there.
Oh, fantastic stuff. We'll have to watch this space. There was quite a lot of hype around the levitation of food a little while back. What are your thoughts on that? Is that something that we're going to see in restaurants?
Possibly. We made the equipment to help colleagues at Sussex, University of Sussex, levitate. And I think they were quite surprised about how different the perceived taste was when you ate levitated food. Okay, the practicalities of it are something that probably needs a bit further work, exactly how the levitated food is delivered into your mouth. But rather amazingly, the food tasted different when delivered that way. Some of the senses were heightened, which is kind of quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had a whiskey company came to visit us some years ago and were interested in levitating droplets of whiskey for a new taste experience. We couldn't, unfortunately, levitate big enough droplets of whiskey to satisfy them, but we tried it out, and actually you get a very intense whiskey taste from a tiny amount of a tiny droplet of whiskey, because I think the ultrasound almost like is evaporating and atomizing the whiskey as it's going into your mouth. So it's like almost like a droplet of whiskey, but also like a sort of a spray of whiskey, and as your smell is so kind of connected to your sense of taste. Rather amazingly, a crazy idea, but some new sensory concepts there.
Hey, that's awesome stuff. And the sort of things that spring to mind for me when it comes to levitating food, with it being a Christmas time of year, and something that maybe doesn't taste quite so good to people, is Brussels sprouts. Kind of funny image of you maybe at Christmas time with Brussels sprouts kind of levitated around your Christmas table. Is that something?
Well, that might be a good idea. My children don't like Brussels sprouts, and I personally am quite a Brussels sprout fan. But I wonder if I could use a levitation system to sort of sneak the Brussels sprouts into their mouths without them noticing it. That could be quite a breakthrough, I think, that could excite parents across the country in getting their kids to eat their greens, not just Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked a bit about a levitation. So what's this new research into bats and moths?
It's all about the evolutionary arms race between moths and bats. So bats eat moths, basically, and moths come out at night when bats are hunting them. And if you look at moths, they're quite different from butterflies, which actually have the same evolutionary origin, but butterflies fly in the day and they're not hunted by bats. So we were looking at the differences between moths and butterflies to see if we could see whether or not they had anything that could be called acoustic camouflage. And of course, we all know that moths tend to be hairier. We all know that. If you look at a moth, they tend to have hairy heads and fluffier bodies. And no one really knows why, although, you know, various theories have been suggested, like it helps them be more insulated. But actually, if you then look, the more insulated ones are not necessarily the ones that live in cold climates. They can be the more insulated ones with the fluffier fur might live in hot climate. So that suggests it's not to do with heat regulation. So anyway, we looked at to what extent they reflect sound, and it turns out they're very good absorbers of sound, the moths. So it would appear, I mean, we can't prove these things directly, but it would appear we can definitely say they're good absorbers of sound. So they would be harder to find than a butterfly. Should butterflies make the mistake of flying at night, they will be quite readily eaten by found, because bats use echolocation using ultrasound, they'd be quite readily found by the bats, whereas the moths absorb some of that sound and so aren't such strong reflectors. So the bat has to get closer to the moth in order to know it's there. And of course, once the bat's located, the moth might be curtains for the moth, but on average, there's a sort of a genetic pressure on the moth to become better and better acoustically camouflaged. So we've shown that from a scientific perspective, that's true, that moths are much less reflective than butterflies of the same size.
And do you reckon that acoustic camouflage, as it's been called, is applicable to lots of other insects too?
The obvious one would be some fish that are hunted, for example, dolphins, particularly in the deep sea environment where there's no light. I mean, a lot of animals hunt each other using, you know, optical perception as well as sound if the animal makes a noise. So you have, I think, for evolution to push acoustic camouflage, it'll have to be in quite specific environments where that's an advantage. So yeah, the other one might be fish trying to hide from dolphins and other porpoises, I suppose.
Ultrasound has got quite a range into a lot of different areas. In the coming year, what do you think is an exciting development that you're hoping to see?
Whether it will happen or not, I don't know. But the thing I'd most like to see is something I mentioned a moment ago, which is to see some of these things we've been doing at larger scales, where we're moving millimetre and centimetre objects, maybe quite big ones relative to the wavelength and lots of them, see some of these ideas get shrunk down to the kind of the microscopic scale, where we can do these things like moving cells, moving small microorganisms, and that means doing those sort of things in a fluid environment rather than in air. So there's quite a lot of technical challenges in doing that and miniaturizing everything. Particularly, we have to make the devices in completely new ways, because they're just, you know, they're sort of too small to kind of put together by hand, you know, on a benchtop. We can't really, it's very hard to solder up sub-millimeter loudspeakers by hand. So that's a long-term goal. Whether I'll make it much progress on it over the next year, or, well, when I say I mean the group of people that work with me, whether we'll make much progress on that over the next year remains to be seen. But it's something that's definitely driving me forward at the moment.
So obviously with the ultrasound stuff, being able to see it yourself is a big part of experiencing how awesome it is. Have you got any events or anything coming up where people will be able to come and see the acoustic demonstrations in action?
Oh, that's a good point. No, I don't at the moment. No, there's nothing particularly. I'm giving a talk in Belgium on this sort of stuff, on tractor beams. But yeah, no UK dates on my tour yet.
Okay, maybe we'll have to sort something out. Is there any sci-fi that you're into?
So I'm not a great reader of science fiction books, but I think that science fiction TV influenced me quite a bit when I was growing up, you know, Star Trek in particular, and Blake 7, I think, as well, which is sort of the British equivalent of that. More recently, although I guess not that recently, I think I was quite influenced, or I think it's quite an interesting and thought-provoking film, 2001 A Space Odyssey. I've always been quite a big fan of that, seen that 3 or 4 times. It's quite a strange film, isn't it? I don't know whether you're a fan of it.
I actually watched it on my birthday last year. It was like a birthday treat with the shed. It was a fantastic film. Have you read the book?
No, I haven't, no. Mm. But I think I like a few bits about it. I think the whole thing with how artificial intelligence and the battle between robots and the humans, it's obviously that's happening on board the spacecraft there. But I think that's something that's developed quite a lot since that film was made, and it's now much closer to reality. You know, with we have all sorts of devices that we can now talk to that talk back to us, don't
yeah,
we? So I think that's all happening, and it's going to happen more and more. And then I think the other thing I kind of find intriguing about it is obviously there's that sort of obelisk thing, isn't there, that we're never quite sure what it's really all about. But I kind of like that kind of ambiguity of there's something mysterious out there. And I think that's kind of how I view science in a way, is that we're trying to work out things that we don't know about. I'd love to have that obelisk and do some experiments on it. But in the absence of that, I dabble with ultrasound and try to do new things, and when I see things I don't understand, try to work out ways of understanding them. So about the filming, I like that ambiguity, the sense that you're never quite sure what's really happening. I think that's quite a cool thing for a film to have. Mm. Not really a happy ending, but a mysterious, ambiguous ending.
Like, because they wrote the book alongside the film, the bit at the beginning where it's kind of just the apes sort of evolving and there's like no real explanation of what's going on, you get a bit more kind of, well, context of like what's happening in the book. Like,
so you actually find out what it's all about, do you? You find out the meaning.
Well, it's not a meaning as such, but you kind of understand like, oh, like we've developed a tool and we can now stand up and we're like improving how we exist. And you get kind of like sort of like an ape man sort of in a monologue and like how he then has like a weird kind of interaction with the obelisk. Like you actually get right. to kind of know what happens in that interaction. So.
Or maybe I'll have to read that then.
Yeah, they kind of go very well together. Stand alone as well.
Well, if you've got it, you'll have to come and lend it to me at some stage.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you very much, Bruce. That's excellent.
Thanks, Maddie, and thanks, Bruce Drinkwater, for joining us. Always a pleasure to hear from Bruce, and of course, Maddie. And we'll see you tomorrow for day 11 of the Cosmic Shed Advent Calendar. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.